Welcome back to Technically Economics. I'm Dominic.
I'm Cassidy.
We are two econ PhD students at Harvard, and we are coming to you from the Cambridge Public Library. Cassidy, can you remind the listeners what the premise of the show is?
Yes. So if this is your first week with us or your memory is not that good, on each episode of this podcast, Dominic or I is going to bring a topic of discussion and try to convince the other one that that topic technically counts as economics.
Yes. And you can follow us on Instagram at Technically Economics. It's going to be important to follow us, as we talked about on the last show, because you can have your say. You can tell us whether we did a good job convincing the other one that something is technically economics, and we're going to compete against each other.
Yes.
And at the end of the season,
I'm going to win.
Yeah, I guess we'll see. One of us is going to win, one of us is going to lose, and I guess one of us is going to do a punishment that we still haven't decided.
Yes, we'll report back on the punishment maybe next episode.
Okay, that sounds good. That sounds good. Today.
Today.
I'm going to try to convince you.
Yes.
This is my second try at this.
And I'm going to be trying to take you down hard.
Now that there's a punishment.
Yes.
I'm going to try to convince you that there is technically economics in youth sports.
Youth sports.
Yeah. Sports for children.
For youth.
For youth.
Okay.
Yeah.
Famously.
So to start out, I just want to ask you a few questions.
Okay. When you have to ask me questions, you say it in an authoritative way that really makes me feel like I'm in trouble.
I guess I'm sorry. I don't know. I had no idea. That was my, okay, let me try to say it in a nicer way. Cassie, we're going to start off. We're just going to chat. I'm just going to ask you a few questions. We're going to have a good time.
Now you sound like good cop. Okay.
Good. Yeah. Did you play any youth sports as a kid?
I did play youth sports. I played soccer until I was about 9.
Okay.
And I played softball from maybe ages 9 to 12.
Whoa.
But then at the point when everyone in the sport was starting to get kind of good, then I had to make my exit.
Okay. Okay. Do you have any funny or embarrassing stories from your time in youth sports?
Unfortunately, I do. And and I knew you were going to talk about youth sports, so I knew this would probably come up. And I was really doing some calculus of, which levels of embarrassing am I okay, putting out into
No one listens to the pod anyway. It's not a big...
I have two.
Okay.
One is actually more embarrassing for my dad than for me because I'm too young to remember it.
Okay.
When I played soccer, I was really not good. Really not good. But also I started playing pretty young at the point where almost no one is good. And the soccer is mostly just watching the kids run around on the field, maybe picking some grass, picking some flowers.
Having some oranges after the game.
Yeah. Enjoying the orange slice.
Yeah.
But even amongst these young children, I think I was uniquely bad.
Okay.
And my dad thought that it would be funny. So he was Cassie's never going to score a goal. And so he always told me.
That's me.
He didn't say that to me.
Okay.
But he told me, Cassidy, if you ever score a goal, you gotta run down the sidelines and shush the audience.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And I was okay, good to know, Dad. And my mom was always don't tell her stuff that. And he's it's fine. This is never gonna come up. The thing about playing when you're 6 years old is sometimes even if you're really bad, everyone else is so bad that you can succeed. And so, sure enough, one day, I score a goal, and my dad is yes! And then he's oh, no. And I did it. As a six-year-old, I ran down the sidelines of the soccer field, shushing the parents.
Oh, no.
Of these other kids.
What were the reactions from them?
I have no recollection. It's one of those things. I feel I feel secondhand embarrassment for my parents,
but
I was sort of too young, but I don't think it really reflects on me.
Yeah. Wow. That is incredible. That's also I feel that's actually a hilarious move for your dad. I don't know. I could see myself pulling that move.
Yeah. It It was really a mark of having no faith in me.
Yeah, that is true. But I don't know, hilarious. It must have been like slightly embarrassing at the time. Kind of hilarious. I don't know.
Yeah. And then I also played softball for longer. I played that until I was a little older. And I think my coach just really didn't know what to do with me. I think he was just like, this sorry sap of a girl. She's got a lot of enthusiasm, but that's about it. And my, like, hitting rate, like, connecting with the ball was so low that after playing softball for truly, like, 3 years, my coach was like, could you be left-handed?
Oh, no!
And he had me switch around and bat left-handed for the rest. And, like, I think maybe my accuracy was 5% higher or something.
So maybe you are left-handed.
Yeah, but my power was terrible. So I'd like hit left-handed and like hit it 4 feet in front of me, grounder to the pitcher. Dang. So it was not, I had to find my skills elsewhere later in life.
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, you did. I don't know. So it sounds like maybe you weren't the most high-level travel sports, youth sports competitor.
No, I never traveled for a sport that I was competing in.
Okay.
Unless spelling bee counts.
Oh, I mean, I wasn't thinking of it, and I'm not going to talk about it, but did you travel for
I went to a state fair once for the spelling bee.
Wow, that's...
Spelling bee at the state fair.
That's pretty Iowa to put the spelling bee. New York is not putting their spelling bee at the state fair, I can tell you that much. There's a spelling bee part of New York. And there's a state fair part of New York, and the
and
two
they don't
do
intersect.
Not interact. Yeah. It's honestly true of Michigan, too. Like, there's a spelling bee part of Michigan, there's a state fair part of Michigan. Not a ton of overlap. So, do you think that you're, like, there's a lot of, like, positives and negatives about youth sports.
Yes.
I think some of the more economics-y pieces are going to be negatives, but I want to take a moment at the beginning and talk about the positives. And so, in your experience, do you think your youth sports, you know, made a positive difference in your life or the lives of others in any way? The lives of your dad, I guess, positive, negative, either way.
I think that this is going to sound like a little dumb, or maybe it's going to sound conceited. I don't know. I'll edit it out later if I sound too full of myself. But I think it was good for me to have something in my life that I was pretty bad at.
Yeah,
like, I think it's good to not specialize at a young age in, like, only the things you're good at, I think. And so, like, obviously, school was easier for me than anything kind of, like, physical. And I don't know that I even, like, I didn't love playing sports ever, but I think it was kind of good for me to just be like doing something that like wasn't really my thing and trying to get you like a little bit more comfortable in unusual settings. Did I take that lesson far enough? I don't really think so, because I quit the sports pretty early and then refused to do any sports in like high school or something. But I do think it was like,
You learned your strengths and weaknesses.
I think that's like a valuable thing.
You don't always need to beat your head against the wall. And
Yes.
And I think a lot of other things, you know, people talk about is like you learn a discipline and like commitment to a team and a lot of those other things. So I think a lot of positives to youth sports and like being in sports. I was actually looking for like if there's like, you know, psychology research, and there's some like sort of correlational stuff. I guess they don't do a lot of like RCTs with like kids in youth sports, but you know, both anecdotally and I think like correlationally, it seems like there's a lot of evidence that youth sports do good things.
Yeah, and I really liked learning little songs, like cheer songs to sing for my
team. Softball, I feel like that's huge.
Yeah, but then, and I kind of like took a lot of pride, I would say, in being, you know, not a contributor to the team on the field, but really a contributor from the bench of keeping the energy up with good songs.
That's huge.
I'd like bring in songs that my mom told me from when she was a kid, like bringing them back out decades later.
Wow, yeah.
But then when we hit like 13 years old, my coach was like, no more songs. We're a serious team now.
I think that's crazy, because I feel like you watch like college softball and they're kind of doing like some degree of songs. I think
he told us we could do cheers where we like cheer for people, but there's no sing song in baseball, that kind of thing.
I see. Okay. I mean, yeah, in baseball, there is no sing song. In softball, though, I feel like, I don't know. And maybe there should be more sing-songing in baseball. I don't know. I don't know why we you know, gender it off like that. It's crazy. It's crazy. Okay. But now we want to get to the economics.
Okay, economics.
And so the first point I want to make is just about how much money there is in youth sports in the U.S. I was doing some research for this, and I think it's pretty crazy.
Okay.
So maybe this is not, like, very deep economics, but it just, like, is, I think, blatantly and transparently economics, the fact that it's this huge industry.
Yeah.
And I'm going to focus mostly in the U.S., at least to start, because I think this is really more true in the U.S. and other parts of the world. We'll talk about other parts of the world, too, later.
Cool.
So in the U.S., I've seen different estimates. One estimate in 2019 said that youth sports was a $19.2 billion industry, which is slightly bigger than the NFL.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to ask. I always want, like, comparisons of these things. Like, what? Okay.
Yeah.
Bigger than the NFL.
And the other thing to note, too, if you're just trying to get a sense of it, so that article, which had done this estimates, they said there had been a 90% increase from 2010 to 2019. So, you know, outpacing inflation by quite a bit.
And bigger than the NFL, sorry, that means like the NFL includes like ticket sales to NFL games
stuff. And this is a revenue number, and then we'll talk about, like, NFL, it's much clearer to say, like, what goes into the revenue number, ticket sales, jerseys, that kind of thing.
Yep.
We'll talk about a second what goes into this number. But another one, this is a survey from the Aspen Institute from 2025, said that families pay $40 billion toward youth sports in 2025, which had risen 46% over the last 5 years.
So
kind of taking over from
one
other thing.
Oh,
so that's just direct costs. You know, they asked families how much they had paid and sort of multiplied that up.
Okay.
But yeah, so a question for you is, what do you think that, like, 19.2 number, what do you think goes into a number like that, or the $40 billion from parents? What kind of expenses do you think people are paying?
Yeah, so I guess if you're playing, I would think a huge part of it would be if you're playing on travel teams, just like the literal travel of getting to places, and if you need hotel rooms or stuff like that.
Yeah.
I'm sure that kind of more personalized coaching and stuff is involved. But I would think, I guess that would be something where I would think, I'm sure it's very expensive, but I would think that that's like really, really the top echelons, or like a very small group of people who's using that. So I wouldn't, maybe I wouldn't expect that to be a huge contributor to the overall number, but I don't know. Yeah. And then I guess there's like obviously gear and just like the kinds of setups you might need to be able to like practice a sport well in your backyard or something. I guess there's some high kind of fixed costs for some of that, even just like putting in a basketball hoop or getting a
So I think that's some of them. So I was reading their methodologies, and it seems like private lessons, like league and team fees and facility fees seem like a big part of it. So just like, you know, you have to write a check to whatever, the coach or something, who's going to like deal with all this stuff.
Yep.
Travel, equipment's another big one.
Yeah,
so something
like
hockey, you got to buy all the pads.
Oh,
stuff like that.
Okay. I'm thinking soccer is like maybe a little bit less of an equipment-heavy sport hockey
more
or football.
The travel and everything. And then another big piece of this is the sort of technology company. So there's these softwares for like leagues and camps. So like if your league has like you know, needs to sort of like organize schedules and games and like field management.
Yeah.
There are these companies that create this software for it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And there's other companies that create this sort of like videos that you can send to colleges and things like that, and like the equipment for that.
Like almost like a PR team or something?
Some of the like video, they're like platforms and things.
Okay.
But again, a lot of it is just like sort of like league tournament camp management. And that's a huge industry. Like one person I was reading said this is like one of the biggest pieces of this. They noted Jerry Jones, the Cowboys owner, is like a big equity owner in one of these different companies that creates this technology for these leagues.
Okay. And is this the kind of thing, like, I mean, I know professional athletes will like watch back footage of their game and stuff.
Yeah.
And like maybe there's software that can kind of do some sort of assessment of like, oh, this is where the angle is wrong. And is it things like that?
I think it can be. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, maybe that gets like maybe your private instructor has that. So maybe it's part of the private lessons. But yeah, I think
all
it can
in
be
there
too.
Okay.
One thing that those, so that's a lot of like the cost towards parents. One thing those numbers don't include directly, which I thought was interesting, is like the spending that cities and counties are doing as well. So I had you read a Time article. And in that article, it includes a story of Westfield, Indiana, which I thought was kind of funny. So it's a town It issued $70 million in bonds to build this huge like sports complex with like 31 fields, 26 softball and baseball diamonds, this huge indoor facility. And I love this quote from a city official. So maybe I'm gonna have you read it because I thought it was like, you know, pretty crazy and shows how this works.
Okay. Westfield officials had considered attempting to draw a minor league baseball team to the city. That gives you some prestige, said Cook, but it's not really our moneymaker. Our moneymaker is regional tournaments under 16 years of age because they bring mom, dad, brother, sister, and grandparents.
Yeah, and I like that. I think that's like, you know, first it's just kind of funny, but it's also like, I think he might be right, which is like, you know, you have these debates around professional sports stadiums, and I mean that could be a whole nother episode, so I won't go into too much detail, but there's the debates about like whether, you know, Chicago should pay for the new Bears stadium or something like that, and the argument is that you're going to have these spillovers because people are going to come to the game, then they're going to go to a restaurant nearby, yeah. And so it really is worth the city helping to pay for it because it's going to create a lot of economic activity.
Yeah.
And I think this guy's right that, like, well, like, maybe that creates some. I think there's a lot of debate and discussion about how much it actually creates. But maybe it's actually right that, like, youth sports is better. You know, you come for a day of tournaments with your, like, three or four kids. You need to go to lunch. You need to get some coffees. You need to, like, run some errands maybe while they're there. Like, I feel like it's not that crazy. It's not that crazy.
Yeah. I went to a couple of months ago at the beginning of the summers, Scott and I went to a WNBA game. We went to see the Connecticut Sun down in Connecticut.
Okay. Yeah.
But they play just at this like big casino, like ultra, I don't know. It's like a casino, but then it's kind of a mall and there's a big restaurant and food court.
Okay.
And the day that this WNBA game was happening, there was also some kind of like youth basketball tournament.
Oh.
And it was just like a sea of basketball families.
Yeah.
Like, I was truly blown away by the number. And, like, I'd never really been to one of these travel sport things because I wasn't good at anything.
Yeah.
But, like, the sheer number of people there astounded me. And I was like, yeah, surely this is great for this casino, like, resort place because they have all these families here. They all, like, need to eat here. There's literally nothing else around this.
Yeah. I played travel baseball in middle school, and I've been to some of those. Like, I remember going to, there's a big one in like the west side of Michigan in like Battle Creek, and so there's like a bunch of fields, and then you go, and there's like food trucks in the parking lot and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And like another one like Toledo, Ohio, that's that way too. So I feel like it's just like there's all these people that have to be there all day because it's also not like a single game, like professional where you're there for 3 hours. It's like, it's game after game after game after game after game. You're just, like, there all day, all weekend.
Yeah.
So, okay, but to return to the bigger picture, one thing I mentioned at the beginning is there have been this rise in spending over the last couple of decades. Do you have any thoughts on what might have driven those time trends, why it might be increasing?
Yeah, so I guess there's a little bit of a cascade effect or something that you might expect here, where like when you're in a competitive space against other people, like even if you're kind of children, then like if part of what you're getting out of it is like the winning, the like beating other people, then say everyone is spending like very little resources on this.
Yeah.
Then I guess if you're willing to just spend a little more resources, then you would have the edge over other people if you think resources are making you better.
Yeah.
And so I could kind of see how if just like over time, spending a little more resources can get one individual the edge.
Yeah.
It makes sense that individuals or communities might come together and like try to do that. But then we kind of talked about this a little bit last week of like partial equilibrium versus general equilibrium. Once people are doing that, then like all of a sudden it becomes you need to do that to keep up and like the boundary just keeps getting pushed.
Yeah. I think that makes sense. Like it makes sense that in, you know, in partial equilibrium, like, oh, you know, there's some incentives for me to try to get private coaching for my kid. But, you know, it feels a little crazy. I don't know. But then if one person does it and it sort of starts this vicious cycle where, okay, then I need to do it. And then if, you know, all of the people on like your high school soccer team had played travel soccer, it's like you're not going to make the team if you hadn't played travel soccer beforehand. Or if all, you know, the best kids in like the pre-high school leagues are like sort of out of the public leagues and into these travel teams, then the public leagues are going to be, you know, just the
yeah,
the worst, the maybe the Cassidy, sorry, of the world. And so again, it starts this sort of like a vicious cycle.
Yeah, the classic little econ-y game theory example, I feel like, that they use to explain this idea of unraveling is, why are all bars so loud?
Oh.
And the idea is, while you want to talk just loud enough that your table can hear you over the other
yeah.
tables, but in order for that to be true, then like the table next to you is going to want to talk louder to hear over your table, and then suddenly everyone in the bar is yelling and it's unpleasant for everyone.
Wow, I've never heard that before. That makes a lot of sense. There are a few more like catalysts of the vicious cycle, maybe, that people have talked about when I was reading. So
okay.
One is there was a big defunding of public leagues, both in the 1970s and then also in the
like
Great Recession.
Public youth sports leagues?
Yeah, yeah. So like,
I didn't know we had those.
Yeah, yeah. So like some cities, you know, we talked about the cities like spending big on complexes now, but used to have these sort of like local city soccer leagues, which, you know, you only pay like $50 or something because the city's partially subsidizing it. I think I played in one of those when I was like young.
Okay.
And there's been like a decline in, you know, cities and counties funding those, which has sort of created a lot more of these private leagues and travel teams.
I see.
That's one thought, at least. Another one, which we're going to talk more about in a second, is rising competition for college and college costs.
And so this
can be sort of a pathway, a real or perceived pathway. So those are some of the things that people think. But I think there is no one right answer. And it's, you know, a bunch of different things that sort of started this vicious cycle.
Yeah, yep.
Okay. But these are sort of like real costs to families. And I do want to pause on that for a second. So here are a couple more stats from that Aspen Institute Project Play study. So it says the average U.S. sports family spent just over $1,000 on their child's primary sport in 2024, which has risen to twice the rate of price inflation since 2024.
Okay, say that again. The average family
yes.
with a child in sports?
Yes, paid a little bit over $1,000
okay.
per year on
okay.
that sport in 2024.
Okay.
And there's this huge diversion across the income distribution. So
yeah.
the richest families who make over $100,000 a year spent like $2,300, and the poorest families who make under $50,000 spent a little under $890. And this is, again, conditional on playing sports. So there's also differences in the rate of playing sports across these.
Okay.
So I think it's a big part of these families' budget. And that Time article that I had you read mentioned a kid named Joey.
Joey Baseball.
Yeah, it went by Joey Baseball. What do you remember about Joey and his family and his teammates?
Yeah, so they're talking about this kid who I think is like 10 years old, maybe 11.
Yeah,
they
yeah.
described him at one point as still thinking Christmas gifts come from a fat man in
yeah,
a red suit.
Yeah.
But I guess he's a baseball wunderkind. And
yeah.
they were talking about he has like this $15,000 batting cage set up in his backyard.
Yeah.
He's doing like private lessons for hitting, private lessons for fielding the ball. He's traveling all over. Like it seemed like he was basically being recruited to like join teams for like one-off tournaments
yeah.
because he's like so good.
Yeah, did you notice he lives in New Jersey, but he's playing for the Texas Bombers?
Yeah,
which I
yeah.
was like, okay.
And it seems like the kid like does really love baseball and
yeah.
he's very passionate about it, but it also seems like the dad is sort of willing to do
yeah.
anything to put the kid's like baseball first.
Yeah, yeah. And one other stat I had in there is he was getting like these hitting lessons for $100 an hour. But yeah, I think you touched on a lot of the other points about how it's sort of like his family really seems squeezed and is trying to do a lot for the kid. Did you notice by chance what year that article was written in?
I did not notice what year
okay,
it was
so
written in.
That article was written in 2017.
Oh, so Joey Baseball's...
Joey, yes.
Where's Joey Baseball now?
He's 18
now?
Years old. Do you want to take a guess at where Joey Baseball is now? I did also look at his Instagram, and to your point, he seems like, yeah, he actually loves baseball. Maybe this is a hint, but like he actually loves baseball. He seems like he's sort of a well-adjusted kid. But
yeah.
he just graduated from high school.
Okay. So my guess is that he is going to be playing baseball in college, but I feel like it's such a lottery of, like, if you can really stay good that long without getting, like, there's just so many things that can happen to you. So my guess is going to be in college, but not actually, like, a superstar anymore.
Yeah, that's pretty close. I think he is maybe not, like, the best player in the country. He is in college. He's playing, it seems like he just started his freshman year at Rutgers.
Okay, but so D1 athlete.
Yeah, he was the number 17 overall prospect in the state of New Jersey, which is, you know, maybe not number one in the country, but that's not terrible. And then I thought, you know, maybe to your point on, like, you don't know how you're going to develop, on the Rutgers page, he's listed at 5'9", 159 pounds. So I feel like he could be, like, the fact that he's playing D1 baseball at that size is, I think, pretty crazy. Like, he's not
okay,
a big
that
kid.
That size is not that meaningful to me.
Oh, I see.
That's small.
It's not large for a, I think for a male baseball player.
Okay.
I mean, baseball is one where, like, there are some smaller players, but I think it size definitely helps. So
okay.
I think that is one thing when you're, like, the best player at 10 years old. Like, you just don't know what you're going to be like after puberty. So yeah, but he does seem like he's playing D1 baseball. And so he was able to do it, I guess.
Okay, he's able to do D1 baseball, but if he's number 17 in New Jersey, probably the odds that he would be, like, a professional baseball player got to be pretty low, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, in the MLB, I mean, there's always, like, minor leagues. And I don't know. I have faith in Joey Baseball. I was on his Instagram for, like, longer than I should have been on Joey's Baseball's Instagram. He seems like a nice kid, well-adjusted and everything. So
That's good. Good for Joey.
So now we've talked about, you know, sort of the most obvious bit of economics in this, just the big dollar amount and how it's affecting families. But maybe a second question I have for you is, you know, given that this is, like, squeezing all of these families so much, why do you think that parents are doing this, or, like, sort of paying all these costs for these kids?
Yeah, so I think if you're a parent, there's, like, and neither of us are parents, so we're simulating
from the
a little
here.
Bit.
Yeah. I have parents.
I have parents as well. Shout out. I do think, and I think most people would agree, that youth sports, like, develop qualities that we think of as good qualities. Like, I think it's good for children to sort of work hard at something and see themselves get better. I think that's extremely rewarding.
Yeah.
I think learning to play in a team in, like, a lot of settings is good for children. Learning how to handle not being the best at something and, like, sometimes losing as you are going to do in sports, I think that's good for children.
Yeah.
And so I can really imagine that, like, if your child has a really dedicated focus on a sport that they love and they want to get better at it and they show meaningful talent, like, they seem like they could be really good at it, then I think as a parent that would be hard to say, no, we're not gonna help you know, get the resources you need to, like, really play this at a competitive level.
No, I agree with that. I think there's some aspect of just, like, your love for your kids and just wanting them to have every opportunity that they can.
Yeah.
I think a slight variant on that where I want to take us next is, you know, in the article it mentioned, like, oh, I really want my kid to have, like, every opportunity in college and to get these college scholarships, which I think is a version of what you're saying. Maybe it's not the sort of, like, inherent, you know, this is going to be good for my child's development, but it's, like, I want them to have this opportunity. And I think that might be part of what's going on here, as I mentioned. So I found this, like, super interesting econ paper when I was preparing for this episode called The Rugrat Race. And I had you take a brief look at it, too.
Yes.
The paper starts with a very simple, like, observation, which is just that after decades of decline, the amount of time that parents spend on childcare in the U.S. suddenly began rising in the mid-1990s. And that was especially true among highly educated, high-income parents.
Okay.
And so the paper says, for example, college-educated mothers added over 9 hours a week on childcare, even though their market wages were higher than ever.
Okay.
And this was at a time when these same college-educated mothers were spending less time on what the paper calls, like, home production activities. So, I don't know, things like cooking and cleaning. So that's declining. They're working more. They're making more. But at the same time, they're spending more time on childcare. And so, Cassidy, maybe you can help the listeners understand why this is like such a puzzling finding from like a very economics-y price theory point of view.
Yeah, yeah. So when we think about incomes going up for people, like a lot of times in the most simple version of the world, we might think of your life as kind of a trade-off between work and leisure.
Yeah.
And when your wages go up, that means, you know, for each hour of work, you're making more money. It also means for each hour of leisure time, you're kind of giving up more money.
Yeah.
Because we call those like the income and the substitution effects.
Yeah.
And so we'd say when you're making more money, on the one hand, you might want to work more because you're going to be more rewarded for that work.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you might want to work less because you wouldn't need to work as much to get the same amount of money. That's kind of the substitution effect.
Yeah.
But in terms of like childcare, we would kind of think like some of that labor, if I'm earning more in my job, you might expect that I'm going to want to spend less time on childcare, or kind of use my income to like outsource certain types of like childcare type activities. Maybe that feels like an over econ way of saying it, because that sort of makes
it fully econ brain.
Yeah.
But I think that's the premise this paper starts with.
Presumably, you know, so maybe to make it a little bit clearer, to think about something like the household labor where this like is true, things like doing the dishes and spending time on laundry. We would be really surprised if people started earning more money and then also spending more time on household labor like that.
Yeah.
And so what this is kind of telling us is like childcare labor is definitely working different things than something like household.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Like in standard economics, when the price of your time goes up, you know, like when your wage goes up, you'd imagine you'd want to be doing more working and substituting away from things like doing the dishes and laundry and childcare as one of those two. You know, I think it's an interesting puzzle, and they're going to offer a particular answer. I don't know if their answer's a full story, but I think there's probably a lot of truth of it. They argue that what changed wasn't parents' preferences. Like one possibility is just like, over time, people started to enjoy childcare more. And they show that doesn't really line up with the time series and like different questions to surveys.
Yeah.
It's not really like concerns about safety. That's another thing people bring up, or like something about flexible work schedule. They have different ways to show that like that doesn't seem to quite line up with what the trends were. And instead, they argue that it is competition for colleges. So starting in the mid-1990s, the number of college-bound kids rose pretty sharply. But the number of slots at like good or elite colleges didn't expand nearly as fast. So these like high income, high educated parents did more to try to chase this sort of like relatively fixed capacity at selective schools.
I see. Interesting.
Yeah. And so the idea is like all this additional childcare is like, you know, driving your kid to different extracurricular activities, like including sports. It's sort of classic economics. There's the scarcity and people respond to that scarcity. You know, devoting more hours to college prepped activities, tutoring, sports, other things like that. And so that's the idea of the rugrat race. It's this sort of like arms race of parental time and investments.
Okay.
Yeah. What do you think of that explanation? You buy it or?
I guess I think it could still be true, or like, do they rule out the explanation that people are making more money? And so suppose I thought that childcare time was just like fully leisure time.
Yeah.
And even if I don't think I'm changing, people are changing in how much they value spending time with children, couldn't you still expect that if they value spending time with children, that like when income goes up, you might just see from their fixed preferences that means they would spend a little more time on childcare?
Yeah, they do discuss the like pure income effects story in the paper. They try to rule it out in the cross section. So like there's both the time series, and then they show like differences in people's, you know, when people get more income, do they seem to spend more time on their kids?
I see.
They show that there's like some income effect like that, but in the cross section, it seems way too small to explain the huge rise in the time series.
Okay.
And so you can, I mean, it's not like a very, you know, it's not a very formal argument that they're making. I think this whole paper is like a you know, in a journal where you kind of like get away with sort of these sorts of things. It's a lot more like big idea discussion-y rather than like super, super rigorous. But that is the way they try to rule that out.
Okay.
Transition to the very last piece. So we talked a lot about the costs of youth sports or family. But I do want to talk a little bit maybe about one of the weirder sort of like revenue sides of youth sports for families. And I think this gets us back actually to some of the things we've been talking about a bunch with like monetization and the internet's ability to let us monetize everything.
Yes.
So you'll remember that Joey Baseball, who we talked about at the beginning, was
had 24,000 Instagram followers
yeah,
at the time of the article.
Yes. And that was in 2017.
Okay.
So at the one hand, like, it's like a crazy number for 2017. On the other hand, maybe he wasn't making a ton of revenue because this was like pre-influencer era. But I want to think now what that might look like in the mid-2020s.
Okay.
And I think we have an example.
I'm nervous.
Do the words Baby Gronk mean anything to you?
Not really.
Okay.
What they mean to me is there's a part of youth culture that I'm not understanding.
Oh, okay.
I know Baby Gronk is a thing, but I don't really know who he is or what he's all about.
Okay. Well, can you read this 100% real, and this is NBC News. Can you read this NBC News headline for us in the pod?
So I'm familiar with this headline. This is literally all I know of Baby Gronk. This is NBC News. Who is Baby Gronk? Did Livy riz him up? What does any of this really mean?
Yeah. So we're going to talk about Baby Gronk.
Okay, you're going to explain Baby Gronk
to me? I'm going to explain Baby Gronk to you.
Excellent.
To the best of my knowledge. I listened to a few podcasts. Like, Baby Gronk and his dad have gone on some podcasts.
So I was listening
to some of those and then some behind the scenes. He is a kid. He's from Texas, and he's now 12 years old.
Okay.
But his dad started making videos of him, like, catching footballs, playing football when he was 8. And so he has like sort of does a lot of like YouTube shorts and TikToks and a bunch of his videos have like millions of views. He has hundreds of thousands of followers on TikTok and YouTube. His dad in some of these interviews says he has like a social media plan for his son's life. So he's trying to make money for him as an influencer. His dad was like a pretty good athlete who had like an injury. And so he's like, I want to like this is his version of the story is like, my son's a pretty good athlete. I want to make sure that, like, if anything happens to him, like, I have this, like, platform for him that he can make money off of no matter what.
Yeah.
Cassidy's rolling her eyes. She doesn't.
Okay.
But it's very sort of, like, 2020s, you know, I don't know, monetizing everything thing. His dad, like, arranged these different college visits and, like, meet and greet, including the famous one that the NBC article mentioned with Livy Dunn, who's a gymnast at LSU and like also an influencer and in this influencer thing. Just to get a feel for what Baby Gronk's content is like, can I show you this video of him on a trip to Georgia?
Yes, please.
With another influencer, Sydney Smith, who I did not know existed until I watched this video.
Georgia, yes, I got your offer. But is there any baddies in Georgia?
So that's Baby Gronk in a nutshell.
Okay.
And there's
okay.
a bunch of, I mean, some of him like football highlights, but then a lot of the big ones are things like that. He has one where he like meets Shaq and Shaq looks not amused.
So in this video, to describe it, since this is an
audio
medium.
Sorry. Yeah.
He like, I don't remember quite what he says, but he's like, Georgia, I got your offer, but are there any, what did he say?
Are there any
baddies in Georgia? This kid's like 12. He's a child.
Yeah.
And then like a beautiful girl who looks like she's in college, like struts over to him. And then they kind of like pose together as though he's like pulled this baddie.
Yeah.
And it made me really uncomfortable.
Yeah. And that's like, you know, a lot of his I mean, that's the Livy Dunn content too. In interviews like with the two of them too, like he will say the like baddies and like I want Gucci and stuff like that. But he's actually like a pretty quiet kid, and it's kind of clear that his like dad's kind of prodding him, which is always a little uncomfortable, I think.
Yeah, I think we should have stopped putting children on the internet after Charlie bit my finger. I think
that was the last time
it was good.
Yeah. but just to wrap it up, so I think they're, you know, maybe we're in sort of a similar place to where you ended with marble racing, which is a, you know, maybe a sort of a dark thought for the 2020s economy, where you're just trying to monetize everything. And I am like, you know, honestly a little torn. I think I agree with you that, like, it's just weird. Seems like you're making the kid the product. It doesn't really seem like it's his choice. And the whole thing feels, like, pretty uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the same time, on face value, his dad is actually sort of brilliant in, like, creating this platform for him. I mean, maybe it's just for the dad, not for the son. I think you can think about that.
I think I just worry a lot about what it means to be maximizing or optimizing for the consumption of others before you have, like, a fully developed brain.
Yeah,
like,
no,
it makes it
that.
Sort of very hard to experiment and decide who you want to be in the world if, like, from before anyone could reasonably come up with that sort of decision, you are taking in feedback on a massive scale and responding to that feedback.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. I think on net, I know on net I come out on the same side of you, where it's just like the whole thing is just like not, it doesn't feel great. So just to sum up, we're going to do the rating now.
Okay.
Just for you and for the people voting on Instagram.
Yes.
I'm going to sum up a few different angles of how I think this is youth sports or economics.
Okay.
So first, there's just a lot of money in this. And that, you know, that feels economics, right? Like that's the whole thing. You know, second, we talked about the Rugrat race and the substitution and income effects. That's like, you know, that was our first semester of econ. That's price theory. That's so econ. and then last, we talked about, you know, similar to what we've talked about before, this sort of like influencer economy, monetization of everything, you know, and how youth sports has become sort of a part of that. So now I'll ask you and the listeners, I guess, but you first, the key question. On a scale from 1 to 10, how economics-y do you think youth sports are?
I'm going to preface by saying that going forward and including today, I'm going to be a little harsher in my
ratings. Oh, that's not a... Okay. That's just not what I wanted to hear to start.
No, I'm putting that out front. Mm. But here's the sense in which I'm going to be a little harsher.
Okay.
I'm going to say, I think if I'm giving something like above a 5...
Yeah.
Then that means it would be crazy, or like it would be kind of crazy to talk about this thing without talking about like the economics of it in some way.
Okay.
The strategic incentives.
I feel like
yes.
I probably hit that bar.
Yeah.
I don't know. We'll see. Yeah.
And then below 5 is going to be more like, there's like economics here, but you could have a good understanding of this topic without meaningfully thinking about economic things.
Yeah, yeah.
But here, I think you're right. I think it would be crazy to talk about youth sports without talking about there are like so many strategic incentives here about like why people are doing what they're doing. I also think it's so important here to think about kind of like the way the system is designed and like how I think economics and sort of strategic interaction, strategic thinking, maybe give us insights about how or why we should expect things to change if we were to modify the system in some way. So like, what do we expect to happen if like more cities invest in like public youth sports? Those are, I think, really important questions if you care about youth sports.
Yeah.
And I think that you just need economics to answer them.
Yeah.
So I think this is a 9.
Whoa. Okay.
I think this is like fully economics.
Wow.
I think you could write a problem set about youth sports.
Whoa. Okay. Listen to that.
And if you disagree with me, if you think, and I kind of hope you do, because again, I'm looking to win, but I got to be honest. If you disagree with me, we'll put a poll on Instagram in a couple days. You can share your thoughts.
Yeah. Vote. Vote early. Vote. I guess not.
Vote
often.
Early, vote often.
Yeah.
You guys can make burner accounts, extra votes. And also, thank you to everyone who has reviewed us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Getting reviews and these kinds of things is like the best thing to help help the pod grow. So if you've been listening, this is episode 4. So honestly, if you're here, you must kind of like us or you really hate us. But in either of those cases,
do you think we have hate listeners? I feel like it's definitely possible.
I feel like we would have hate listeners.
Yeah.
But I think if you hate us enough to listen, then. I don't know.
5 stars. I hate listening to this podcast.
Yeah, give us a 5-star review about how much you hate us.
Yeah.
share with others who you think might hate us too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening, team. We'll see you next time.
Yeah. Be-o, 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 be-o.